From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for Al Monitor and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. The Islamic State continued its onslaught in Iraq, inching closer to the Iraqi Kurdish capital Erbil and forcing an ancient religious minority, the Yazidis, to flee their ancestral home. U.S. planes conducted a humanitarian airdrop, and President Obama authorized airstrikes to protect U.S. personnel in Erbil and to halt the Islamic State's advance. Fighting resumed in Gaza after a three-day ceasefire in a month-long war that killed nearly 2,000 Palestinians, many of them children, and more than 60 Israelis, most of them soldiers. Russia announced that it was blocking imports of food and other agricultural products from Europe and the United States to retaliate for new sanctions imposed on Russia because of its support for rebels in eastern Ukraine. And in Washington, President Barack Obama hosted top officials from 50 African countries for a summit intended to showcase Africa's economic potential instead of its persistent problems. Stephen, let's start with Iraq. How has the United States been dragged back into Iraq? And is there any other country that can possibly stop the advance of ISIS?
The president has authorized airstrikes, as you say, to protect this religious minority, the Yazidis, and to stop the advance of ISIS on Erbil if necessary. But the problem is, whenever you deploy U.S. military force, you know, you don't know how it's going to end. The president laid out what he sees as his kind of doctrine of military intervention in Iraq, a country in which he said he was elected to get troops home from. So he's saying that it's action, first of all, on behalf of a humanitarian principle, rescuing this Yazidi minority, 40,000 of whom are up on this mountain from what is ethnic cleansing and, you know, to all intents and purposes, a genocide at the hands of this ISIS group. And he said that he was going to try to stem the advance on Erbil and the Kurdish areas as a way to protect U.S. teams that are actually on the ground assessing the military situation. Well, you know, I guess you could say the best way to protect a U.S. team would be to get a U.S. team out of harm's way. So it's almost like he is justifying this action he knows he has to take to stop Erbil, but trying to give a limited rationale for doing so. So, but you're right, it's clear that the president, you know, he's been loath to launch U.S. military action in the Middle East. He's very skeptical that U.S. bombing can actually change the situation on the ground in countries like Iraq and Syria. And it seemed like it was a step he was very, very reluctant to take. But in a way, you know, he doesn't have a lot of choice right now.
Tim, do you think congressional opinion will be with him on this? I know there isn't much support for U.S. getting militarily involved anywhere right now in Congress. But given the extreme circumstances, how do you think Congress is going to react to all of this?
Well, Congress has been divided about further action in Iraq, but I think when lawmakers look at the humanitarian crisis of which the president is primarily responding to, I mean, there is a sense that there's an atrocity going on, that this minority group, the Yazidis, are being wiped off the face of the planet merely for not adhering to the very radical form of Islam that's being represented by ISIS. And so when you talk about airdrops for food and water for people who are starving and dying of thirst on a mountain, it's hard for lawmakers to say, no, we won't give these MREs, these packs of food that the military usually uses to eat. We won't give this food aid to people who are dying. It's very hard for me to see that.
Yeah, well, look, there are many horrible humanitarian situations around the world. The question is, you know, U.S. acts when it can and when it thinks the consequences won't be worse. Still, if you look at the comments that led up to this authorization of both airdrops and now airstrikes, you see that the White House, the State Department were being very, very careful. And the White House spokesman, Josh Earnest, kept insisting that there are no American military solutions to the problems in Iraq, you know, a few hours before our military began to act in Iraq. The U.S. obviously was trying to leverage its assistance to get some political progress in Baghdad. They got some, but not everything they wanted. Maliki was still hanging on by his fingernails when last I checked. But obviously, events moved so fast even that finally the White House had to do something.
Right. You know, there's a sense that the last administration, the Bush administration, looked at the evidence and took military action whenever it could find a justification. This administration is almost exactly the opposite. It almost looks for every excuse not to take military action. So while it's true that there's no military solution to a U.S.-imposed military solution to what the problem is in Iraq, it did seem that the administration was using the political chaos, Maliki's refusal to reach out to Sunni and Kurdish factions, as an excuse not to get further involved, a public way of saying, well, we can't take action because it's going to be futile. Now, obviously, that situation has changed, but there is still no appetite on the administration's part to get pulled back in a major way in Iraq. You know, whenever the president talks about this, he repeatedly says there'll be no U.S. ground forces deployed. But this whole humanitarian operation raises a question. You know, how much can you help these people by simply dropping humanitarian aid? Is it enough to degrade the capabilities of the ISIS forces, you know, in the valleys below the mountain to allow them an escape route? It seems pretty far-fetched to think that just dropping food and bombing ISIS below these people is going to help them. You know, at some point, there's going to be a need to help them get off this mountain. And once you've got involved in the start of that, how do you then, you know, say, well, we can't deploy any forces to help these people get down? So,
yeah,
like I said, whenever you organize any military action, you get pulled in unpredictable ways. And everyone always talks about mission creep as, you know, the idea that once you launch action, you get pulled into something else. But it looks like that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, we should say a word about the Yazidis. This is a really ancient sect that has a religion that combines aspects of Zoroastrianism, which is a very ancient Persian religion, with aspects of Islam. So the Islamic State considers them worse than apostates, but then the Islamic State seems to consider anybody who isn't part of the Islamic State worse than apostates. Tim, maybe just one more word on this situation. There have been reports that ISIS, or IS as they call themselves now, has taken the largest dam in Iraq, the Mosul Dam, which would give them the ability to stop the water, stop the electricity, or flood going as far south as Baghdad. The Kurds have forces, the Peshmerga, who've been trying to hold the line against IS, but they have complained that they have old Russian weapons, and the ISIS is now flush with captured American weaponry, which is much superior. So it does seem that in this situation, in order to prevent the entire state of Iraq from collapsing, the United States is going to have to get more deeply involved.
Well, yeah, I mean, so Stephen makes an excellent point about mission creep. What we're seeing right now, he's using prior actions that he's taken to justify current actions and may use these current actions to justify further actions. When the president says we're authorizing airstrikes so that we can protect the people who are in Kurdistan that we've sent there, you know, when he originally sent advisors to Iraq, he said the White House position was that we are not afraid of mission creep. This is just a limited amount of special forces that we're sending in to advise and gather intelligence on what's happening on the ground in Iraq. And now we're seeing that, well, we actually have to protect these soldiers and we'll have airstrikes. So what's the next step? It's hard to argue that the United States doesn't have some responsibility for what is happening right now in Iraq, having occupied the country for a decade.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what we're seeing is an absolute humanitarian crisis bordering on genocide. We're seeing a humanitarian crisis in which millions of people in Mosul are threatened because of the Islamic State's control of this dam, which, if they open the floodgates, could kill thousands and thousands of people with very little warning. The United States does have a responsibility to act here because of their involvement in Iraq. And now they've found themselves in an almost impossible situation where the president needs to kind of find a fix to this problem and where there is no easy American military response that could solve it.
Yeah, I go back again to Congress. Didn't Congress pass a resolution specifically not authorizing more military force, or am I confusing it with Syria?
They have not passed a resolution saying that you can't use any military
force. So the old authorization for military force that
it's
George
legally
Bush passed
debatable.
Is legally still in force, the one from 2002.
Well, it's legally still debatable because the original Iraq resolution was based on things like weapons of mass destruction.
I believe that officials said after the president's speech that they were not going to act under the authorization of military force, but we're going to seek a new authorization under the War Powers Act from Congress.
Well, Congress is out, so how do they go about doing that?
I think that under the law, the president, I think he has 30 or 60 days, some statutory period to inform Congress that he's taking action. So I think they can get it in under the wire under that method.
All right. Well, let's turn to another situation which is as or more troubling, and that is the situation in Gaza. There was a three-day ceasefire. It gave people a chance to assess the degree of devastation, which was huge. Immediately after the ceasefire period expired, more fire exchanged. Not clear whether the ceasefire is going to be restored or we're going to go back into full-scale combat. What, if anything, have we learned from this experience? And is it going to be possible to reach some sort of stable equilibrium between Hamas and the Israelis?
No evidence of that right now. What have we learned? In this incident, as compared to prior incidents, I feel there's been less worldwide condemnation of Israel. I mean, there has been a lot of criticism, but the kind of outrage that we've seen in years past has diminished.
I'm not sure if I would agree with you. I may be on the governmental level, but I'm not sure if I would agree with you, certainly in terms of public opinion. Stephen, I would see that Israel actually has been hit quite hard because of the extraordinary numbers of children killed, something like 400 children killed among the nearly 2,000 Palestinians killed so far.
Certainly in Europe, there's been a lot of widespread public outrage. But I think in some quarters of the Arab world, you're not seeing the same anger and pressure on the Israelis or on the United States to act to rein in the Israelis. Partly that's to do with the fact that Hamas is not a popular force anymore in the Middle East. Some of its previous allies are sort of concerned about its actions. You have an Egyptian government which seems to have been working behind the scenes with the Israelis to de facto pressure Hamas, which it sees as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood.
It is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right, so you have that issue there. You know, and there's so much terrible bloodshed going on in the Middle East. You know, while this has been taking place, we've seen ISIS again march across Iraq, massive killings in Syria that don't really make the headlines anywhere else. So there's almost a surfeit of tragedy that perhaps the sort of civilian carnage in Gaza is not getting the attention it once did. But I guess the enduring memory in many people's view of this conflict will be those kids that were killed playing soccer on a beach. And that's probably a damaging image for Israel's public relations, at least. And we may see that support for Palestinian efforts to sort of forge legitimacy in the UN and in the world court may actually increase as a result of this. I don't know.
Yeah. Tim, if they can get the ceasefire restored, one possibility is that the crisis could be used to strengthen Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. There's been a lot of talk about giving the Palestinian Authority, which was basically forced out of Gaza in 2007, giving them authority to patrol the crossing point at Rafah between Gaza and Egypt, giving them more authority over reconstruction, which will have to be huge in Gaza. Hundreds of thousands of people now are homeless, many, many buildings, factories, homes destroyed. So using the crisis to beef up Abbas and the Palestinian Authority and make them once again the leaders of the Palestinian people, not just in the West Bank, but also in Gaza. Perhaps that's wishful thinking now. What do you think?
Well, there's been a lot of praise from Israeli circles and even from the president for Mahmoud Abbas and his restraint during the current crisis. You'll notice that the kind of violence that erupted in Gaza hasn't emerged from the West Bank. There's a good reason for that. And so wanting to shift the balance of power away from Hamas, which sees as its very goal the destruction of the State of Israel, is...
I'm not sure if it sees that or its mere survival is what it's after now.
Its stated goal is the destruction of Israel. and shifting the balance of power from Hamas towards the Palestinian Authority, I think, is a much more palatable option for both Israelis and the United States.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. Joining me today are Tim Mack of The Daily Beast and Stephen Collinson of AFP. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Stephen, do you think it's possible to use this crisis in a way that might actually help Abbas? Before the war broke out, there had been a unity government, technocratic cabinet formed between Abbas and Hamas, which, you know, ostensibly was going to allow Abbas to take the lead on peace negotiations, foreign policy, that sort of thing.
I think it's a good idea in theory. Whether it will actually work is unclear. First of all, Abbas has not necessarily shown himself as an adept politician personally. Second, his support base among the Palestinian people is not what it was. A lot of people in the West Bank don't really see a dividend or for 20 years of peace talks with the Israelis. There's not a great deal of public support for it. The question is also, how will the Palestinian people react to Hamas and its actions in dragging the people of Gaza into this? Will they sort of gather around in a show of solidarity? Will Hamas get increased legitimacy by standing up to Israel? Or will the Palestinian people in Gaza start to think, well, what did we get for losing, you know, so much in this conflict? I'm a little skeptical of outsiders, United States, Egypt, the Arab League, trying to manipulate this crisis to produce outcomes in Palestinian politics. It seems to me that it's been tried before and it never really works.
Yeah, and of course Hamas has shown an ability to continue to fire rockets into Israel, which provoke an Israeli response. So something is going to have to change in this dynamic to get Hamas to agree at least to a relatively longer-term ceasefire than just 3 days. But I think there are some aspects of the regional situation that do offer some possibilities. Egypt is very tough against Hamas. The Saudis are furious with Hamas, and it's possible that they could bolster the Palestinian Authority and try to give Abbas the financial wherewithal. Certainly the Saudis can do that to begin to deliver for the Palestinian people. But we will turn now to yet another crisis, and that is both economic and military, Tim, and that's the situation in Ukraine. Every time the United States and the Europeans announce new sanctions against Russia, Russia seems to take a retaliatory action. Now it's taken one which will hurt American farmers and hurt European farmers in the pocketbook, but will also hurt the Russian people. Mm-hmm. Russians have come to appreciate American and European foodstuffs and other products, and now those apparently are going to be taken off the shelves.
Well, this is kind of the latest salvo between the West and Russia in terms of economic sanctions. Vladimir Putin has said that this is in retaliation for American and European sanctions against people that are close to him that are largely economic sanctions. I'm not sure that they have a lot of teeth, except that they will, as you mentioned, harm a lot of Russians who are interested in purchasing food or agricultural imports from the West. I mean, Russia has a long history of responding to geopolitical crises by imposing food sanctions. It's not a coincidence that, for example, McDonald's in Russia is being investigated now for E. coli violations. After the original problems and tensions between Russia and Ukraine, Russia immediately moved to start halting the import of agricultural goods from the Ukraine. So this is a long history. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that Russia wants it to be seen as a show of strength. But the secondary outcome really is that, well, if Russia's only real sanctions involve food and not economics, it shows the position that Russia's in, which is not very strong.
Stephen, the Europeans are going to be hit hardest. They're going to lose something like $15 billion in exports if this goes through.
Yeah. Obviously, Europe has much closer ties to Russia than the United States. In the short term, it actually might be quite popular in Europe, unless you're an apple farmer in Poland or producing brie in France, because we'll probably see a surfeit of these goods on the market, which will actually lower prices in the short term. The other sort of question about this is, who is it actually going to hurt? It's probably going to hurt sort of middle-class people in Russia who have got used to having brie and consumer...
And American chicken legs.
Yeah, and consumer goods from the West. The real sort of rich people in Russia are going to find this stuff on the black market. They're rich enough to get it anyway. So therefore, you have to look at, why is Putin doing this? In a way, it's symbolic, because it's symptomatic of this cutting Russia off from the West that we've seen throughout the last 2 years since he returned to the presidency. A sort of a cultural and economic, almost psychological return to Russia as a more isolated nation that's not so dependent and entwined with Western Europe and the whole idea of the West. It's Russia standing alone. And someone also said to me that one effect of this may be to bolster Putin's political support in the regions, where he gets a lot of his support among poorer people, among people who resent the rich, the middle-class people in Moscow. So there may be some political shrewdness behind this this action, which on the face of it just looks like a case of, you know, as you say in England, cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah, but, we say that here too.
Right, right. So it's, you know, on the face of it, it doesn't seem to make sense. But if you look at the sort of general trajectory of Russia under Putin, it makes quite a lot of sense.
Well, there aren't too many other areas in which Russia can act, I suppose, Tim. You know, it can't really impose, what other kinds of sanctions can it impose on the West in retaliation? Meanwhile, in Ukraine, fighting is continuing. Mm-hmm. Finally, the rebels allowed in some authorities to look at the crash site of the Malaysian airliner, and they had to suspend their operations because of fighting in the area. Mm-hmm. Ukrainian forces have made some progress, but there's a lot of fighting still going on around Donetsk. And most worrisome, the Russians have put more troops along the border again.
Yeah, I mean, we're really on the brink right now of a Russian invasion. As Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said this week, there is a real danger of a ground incursion by Russia. I mean, but then you have to ask again, like we've been talking about, whether this is because Moscow has this surplus of strength, or because it's acting out of desperation, that its previous actions in aiding rebels in East Ukraine have not been successful, and that Ukraine is slowly being able to regain lost ground and threaten its objectives in this skirmish.
Yeah. There are so many crises. It's August, normally, when people, you know, take time off and go to the beach. But, I mean, we have a situation now where the Russians could invade Ukraine, profiting from the fact that there's fighting in the Middle East, and the United States is distracted by Gaza and by Iraq. It's really, it's hard to think of another August when you had so many crises converging. I can think of previous times when you had one war here or there, or, you know, invasion of Georgia, something like that. But this is really extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of symptomatic of shifts that are taking place all over the world. The nations like Russia and China are testing what the U.S. sees as the kind of rules of the road of established behavior. You have the United States, which is trying to extricate itself from foreign quagmires overseas, with, as we've seen with Iraq, limited results. You have Europe, which is still crippled by the economic crisis. Its defense budgets are splintered. So you have comparative U.S. weakness and rising geopolitical strength of nations like Russia and China, and that's what's causing all these crises to converge at the same time.
I actually heard an interesting analysis that the Israelis increasingly, and of course we saw their treatment of Secretary John Kerry during this crisis, that they are feeling more independent of the United States because of their relations with countries like Russia and China and India, which did not condemn the Gaza war, Israel's ground invasion of Gaza. So we do have, I think, a lot of moving tectonic plates. But before we end today, I did want to just have a brief mention, Tim, of the Africa Summit. Extraordinary. Mm-hmm. 50 heads of state, senior officials from all of these countries, announcements of more aid to Africa, but also of business deals. Why did President Obama have this Africa summit? And do you think that that in the long term might actually have more meaning than some of these other crises we've been discussing?
It's possible, but I mean, there are great opportunities in Africa for economic development. I think if you look at foreign investment, the profits that you make off each dollar of investment in Africa is quite high, but that's because it's a high risk, high reward kind of economic scenario. But problems, like the president said this week, problems remain very deeply rooted in the continent. Problems with corruption, with freedom of the press, with basic human rights violations will continue to dog the country, as well as public health problems like that we've been seeing, like the current Ebola crisis, but much more deeply the HIV/AIDS crisis on the continent, all of which combine to create a very challenging situation. So while it's nice to have economic deals and have a big summit in Washington, D.C., the challenges still remain much deeper than a few days of leaders convening can solve.
Stephen, I'll give you the last word on this. We'll note that, of course, Africa has a very young population compared to many other places. This is one of the reasons for optimism that these are potentially members of a middle class, potential consumers, and so on. And Obama, of course, is part Kenyan in his origin. So I'm sure this had some special meaning for him.
Certainly. Just quickly, I think the irony of this summit was it was held to challenge the idea that Africa is beset with problems. It took place under the shadow of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. There was so much talk in the U.S. media about it that it infuriated some of the leaders. From the president's point of view, I think he wanted to counter the impression that he had not focused enough on Africa after taking office at a time of great global tumult and economic crisis. And secondly, this is a continuum in U.S. policy. President Clinton set up the Africa Growth and Opportunities Act. President Bush did the a massive anti-AIDS program. And President Obama was followed on by targeting a massive increase in power in Africa. So there is a trend through U.S. foreign policy. And finally, the U.S. also wanted to signal to China, which has been investing billions of dollars in improving trade links with Africa and infrastructure, that it's not going to be left behind in the sort of the new great game in Africa.
Very good. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for El Monitor and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.